At an order from Colonel Abebe, the jeep swung onto a side road and skirted the city, speeding down rutted roads between the crowded flat-roofed hovels. Abebe used the radio, speaking swiftly in Amharic, and then translating for Ramon. "I have men watching Andom's palace," he explained. "He seems to have called a meeting of all of the officers in the Derg who support him. They are assembling now." "Good. All the chickens will be in one nest." The column turned away from the city and sped through the open fields. They were bare and desiccated. The drought had left no blade of grass or green leaf. The chalky rocks that littered the earth were white as skulls. "There," Abebe pointed ahead. The general was a member of the nobility, and his residence stood a few miles outside the city on the first of a series of low hills. The hills were bare except for the grove of Australian eucalyptus trees that surrounded the palace. Even these drooped in the heat and the drought. The palace was surrounded by a thick wall of red terracotta. At a glance, Ramon saw that it was a formidable fortification. It would require artillery to breach it. Abebe had read his thoughts. "We have surprise on our side," he pointed out. "There is a good chance that we will be able to drive in through the gate." "No," Ramon contradicted him. "They will have seen the aircraft arriving. That is probably why Andom has called his council." Out on a rocky plain between them and the palace, a staff car was speeding towards the open gate. "Pull in here," Ramon ordered, and the column halted in a fold of ground. Ramon stood on the rear seat of the open jeep and focused his binoculars on the gateway in the palace wall. He watched the staff car drive through it, and then the massive wooden gate swung ponderously closed. "Where is Tafu with his tanks?" "He is still in barracks, on the other side of the city." "How long to get them here?"
2 hours.
"Every minute is vital," Ramon spoke without lowering his binoculars. "Order Tafu to bring his armour in as quickly as possible, but we cannot wait until he arrives." Abebe turned on the radio, and Ramon dropped the binoculars onto his chest and jumped down from the jeep. The commander of the paratroopers and his company leaders gathered around him, and he gave his orders quietly, pointing out the features of the terrain as he spoke. Abebe hung up the microphone of the radio and came to join them. "Colonel Tafu has one T-53 in the city, guarding the Emperor's palace. He is sending it to us now. It will be here in an hour. The rest of the squadron will follow."
"Very good," Ramon nodded.
"Now, describe the layout of the interior of Andom's palace over there. Where will we find Andom himself?"
They squatted in a circle while Abebe sketched in the dust, and then Ramon gave his final orders.
Once again the column moved forward, but now there was a large white flag on the bonnet of the command jeep, a bedsheet that fluttered on its makeshift flagpole. The trucks kept in tight formation. The paratroopers were concealed beneath the hoods of the troop carriers, and all weapons were kept out of sight. As they approached the palace, a line of heads appeared over the wall above the gate, but the flag of truce had an inhibiting effect, and no shot was fired. The lead jeep drew up in front of the gate, and Ramon assessed its strength. The gate was of weathered teak, almost a foot thick, reinforced with bands of wrought iron. The hinges were rebated into the columns on each side of the gateway. He abandoned any idea of driving a truck through it. From the top of the wall, 20 feet above them, the captain of the guard challenged them in Amharic, and Abebe stood up to reply. They haggled for a few minutes, with Abebe repeating that he had an urgent dispatch for General Andom and demanding entrance. The guard shouted back his refusal, and the exchange became heated. As soon as Ramon was certain that all the guard's attention was on the jeep, he spoke softly into the two-way radio. The trucks behind the jeep roared forward and then peeled off left and right. They bumped over the rocky ground on each side of the roadway and drew up below the walls. From under the canvas hoods, paratroopers clambered onto the roofs of the vehicles. 10 of them were armed with grappling hooks, which they swung around their heads and then heaved up over the top of the wall. The nylon ropes streamed out behind them and dangled down. "Open fire!" Ramon snapped into the radio, and a storm of automatic fire swept the top of the wall, kicking lumps of clay and brick from the rim. The ricochets whined away into the branches of the blue gum trees. The heads of guards disappeared instantly, some of them ducking away, but at least one of them hit by a bullet. Ramon saw his helmet spin into the air and the top lift off his skull.
A pink mist of blood and brain hung in the air for an instant after he was snatched away. Now the paratroopers were swarming up the wall, three or four of them on each dangling rope at the same time. They were as agile as monkeys, and within seconds 30 of them were over and into the palace grounds. There were bursts of automatic fire and the thump of a single grenade. Seconds later, the great wooden gate swung open, and Ramon urged the jeep driver forward. The bodies of the palace guards lay in the courtyard where they had been shot down. Ramon saw one of his paras huddled beside the gateway, clutching his belly, with blood oozing through his fingers. The other paras grabbed onto the jeep as it roared forward. Ramon was standing behind the 50-caliber Browning heavy machine gun that was mounted above the driver's seat. He fired a long, raking burst at the remaining guards as they fled like rabbits into the maze of adobe buildings on the far side of the courtyard. One of the guards whirled and dropped on his knee. He raised the launcher of the RPG-7 rocket he carried on his shoulder and aimed at the approaching jeep. Ramon swiveled the Browning onto him, but at that moment the front wheel struck one of the corpses and the jeep bounced wildly, throwing his aim high. The guard fired the rocket, and it whooshed across the open courtyard and hit the jeep full in the center of the radiator. There was a flash and a roar as the rocket exploded. Although the engine block smothered most of the blast, the front suspension collapsed and the vehicle cartwheeled end over end. They were all thrown clear, but the shattered body of the jeep blocked the entrance, and the troop trucks were backed up beyond the open gateway. The attack was stalling already, and the defense was rallying. Automatic fire was stuttering from the windows and doorways of the palace building. The Cuban paras sprang out of the stationary trucks and rushed forward, but another rocket hissed down the alley facing them. It flashed inches over Ramon's head, blinding him with smoke, and struck the leading truck, ripping the bonnet open and shattering the windscreen. Diesel fuel spilled from the ruptured tank and ignited with a sullen roar. Black smoke billowed over the courtyard. There was shouting and more firing in front of them. Beside Ramon, another para was hit and went sprawling. Ramon snatched up his machine pistol and waved the attack forward, just as a heavy machine gun opened up on them from one of the windows. Ramon rolled under the blast of shot and came up against the mud wall directly below the window. The machine gun was firing over his head, and the muzzle blast drove in his eardrums. Ramon snatched a grenade from his webbing pocket, pulled the pin, and went up on one knee to post it through the window. He ducked and covered his ears. There was a wild shout, and the machine gun fell silent. Moments later, the grenade exhaled in a fiery breath above his head. "Come on!" Ramon yelled again, and led half a dozen paras through the shattered window. The gun had been knocked off its mounting, and the floor was wet and slippery with blood. It was room to room and hand to hand now. The advantage passed to the defenders, as they retreated through the maze of rooms and alleys and courtyards, doggedly holding each strong point until they were driven from it. Slowly the attack lost impetus, and although Ramon threatened and swore and tried to inspire them with his example, they bogged down in the twisting alleys and interconnecting passageways and rooms. He realized that Andom was certainly radioing for reinforcements of loyal troops, and that minutes lost now could mean the defeat and failure of the revolution. He heard Abebe's voice raised angrily, urging his men on in a fog of smoke and dust, and Ramon crawled across to him and seized his shoulder. Face to dusty, smoke-grimed face, they shouted at each other to make themselves heard above the cacophony of guns. "Where's that bloody tank? How long since I called? It's over an hour." Was it that long? It seemed that minutes had passed since the attack began. "Get back to the radio," Ramon yelled. "Tell them." At that moment they both heard it, the shrill metallic squeal and the rumble of the tracks. "Come on!" Ramon lunged to his feet and they ran together, doubled over, with bullets fluttering in the air around their heads, back through the blood-smeared rooms with walls pocked by bullet and shrapnel. As they reached the entrance courtyard, the tank butted its way in through the blocked gateway. The turret was reversed, the long 55mm gun barrel pointed backwards. The carcass of the rocket-shattered jeep was forced forward by the mass of armour, and it rolled clear of the gateway. The T-53 burst into the courtyard with its diesels bellowing. The turret was open. The commander's helmeted head protruded from the hatch. Ramon windmilled his right arm in the cavalry signal to advance and pointed into the tangle of alleys and buildings. The tank pivoted on its churning steel tracks and crashed into the nearest wall. The mud bricks collapsed before it, and the roof tilted and sagged and buried the T-53 beneath it. The tank shook itself free and roared forward. Ramon and his paras poured into the breach it had opened. Walls toppled and timbers crackled as the steel monster crawled forward, tilting and rocking over piles of rubble and human bodies. The screams of the defenders rose higher than the uproar, and their firing died away. They came stumbling out of the ruined buildings, throwing down their weapons and raising their arms in surrender. "Where is Andam?" Ramon's throat was rough and sore with the dust and the shouting. "We must get him. Don't let him escape." The general was amongst the last to surrender. Only when the T-53 flattened the thick mud walls of the main hall did he come out with four of his senior officers. There was a blood-soaked bandage around his forehead and over his left eye. His beard was thick with dust and blood, and one of the scarlet tabs was torn from his collar. His good eye was fierce. Despite his wound, his voice was firm and his bearing dignified. "Colonel Abebe," he challenged, "this is mutiny and treachery. I am the president of Ethiopia. My appointment was confirmed by the Derg this morning." Ramon nodded to his paratroopers. They seized the general's arms and forced him to his knees. Ramon opened the flap of his holster and handed his Tokarev pistol to Abebe. The colonel placed the muzzle between the captive's eyes and said quietly, "President Amon Andom, in the name of the People's Revolution, I call upon you to resign." And he blew the top off the general's skull. The corpse fell face forward, splattering custard yellow brains out onto Ebebe's boots. Ebebe clicked the safety on the Tokarev, reversed it, and handed it butt first to Ramon. "Thank you, Colonel General," he said. "I am honored to have been of service," Ramon bowed formally as he accepted the weapon back. "How many members of the Derg voted for Andam?" he asked as the column sped back towards Addis Ababa. 63. "Then we will have much work to do before the revolution is secure." Abebe radioed ahead to Colonel Tafu's squadron of T-53 tanks. They were entering from the eastern side of the city, and he ordered them to surround the building that housed the Derg and to train their guns upon it. Elements of the army were ordered to seal off all foreign embassies and consulates. No legation staff were allowed to leave the premises for their own safety. All foreigners in the country, especially journalists or television personnel, were rounded up and escorted to the airport for immediate evacuation. There were to be no witnesses of what followed. Small units of Abebe's most loyal troops, backed up by Cuban paratroopers, were rushed to the homes of the members of the military council and the Derg who had declared for Andam. They were stripped of weapons and badges of rank, dragged out, and thrown into the waiting trucks and driven back to the Derg, where a revolutionary court awaited them in the main assembly chamber. The court consisted of Colonel Abebe and two of his junior officers. "You are accused of counter-revolutionary criminal acts against the People's Democratic Government. Have you anything to say before sentence of death is passed upon you?" They were taken out directly from the trial into the courtyard of the building, placed against the north wall of the chamber, and executed by a firing squad. The executions were carried out in full view of the revolutionary judges and those prisoners still awaiting trial. The volleys of rifle fire periodically interrupted the proceedings of the court. The corpses were tied in bunches by the heels and dragged behind a truck through the streets to the main rubbish dump outside the city limits. "The populace must witness the course of revolutionary justice and the price of disobedience," Ramon explained the necessity of these exhibitions. The court ruled that the corpses should not be removed from the rubbish dump, and their families were forbidden to indulge in the ritual of mourning or to exhibit any public signs of grief. The grim work went on until after midnight, and the last batch of criminals was executed in the beams of the headlights of the trucks waiting to drag them to the rubbish tip.